Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Canis Albinus.
Makalua.
The Man Team.
Mega Bears Fan.
Are we streaming? That means we can go. Welcome to Polycast episode 416. I am your main, or lead co-host, I guess, Canis Albinus, and I'm joined by the illustrious Makalua.
I don't know, it's a little too early for me to be illustrious.
And the, I forget what I was going to say for the Mian team, but the fantastic, maybe?
I offer to trade illustrious for iron.
How about magnificent? We'll make you magnificent, Mian team.
Okay. I accept. Thanks for the iron.
Yeah. I'm really glad that it's not super windy here today like it was a few days ago, because I lost power 6 times that day.
Hey.
But, and then I remember, well, at least I'm not on top of Mount Washington, where it was 128 mile per hour winds and got a record low wind chill in the United States and took the crown away from Alaska as the coldest state in America.
Isn't it something ridiculous? Like 98 below or something like that, or
the wind chill was 107 below on Mount Washington in New Hampshire.
All right, time to make the claim territory in Antarctica, a state. Let's go.
I mean, I guess the U.S. does have Antarctic territory, but I don't think that counts.
Well, it's not a state. We have to first make it a
first
state.
First, we have
for
to
it
make
to
it a
count.
State. And yeah. There's some other places that would like to be a state before Antarctica, who probably deserve it. So.
Nope, Antarctica. Move to the top of the queue.
Let's go with the Upper Peninsula of Michigan first. And then after that, we can go to Puerto Rico and American Samoa and Guam and the Northern Mariana Islands. Although Guam and the Northern Mariana Islands would probably be a single state.
Some of them actually don't want it, right? Whatever. In the weeds here.
Well,
Antarctica, they want it. Or if they don't, we can, like, put 5 people there who say they do. And
the
then
5 people who run the research station want to be a state. Yeah, that's it.
I mean, I'm sure we can find a couple people to send there to say that they want to be a state.
Speaking of people and leaders,
we have topics.
Yeah, we do have topics. Leader Pass Pack 4, the Rulers of the Sahara, has been revealed. It's going to come out February 16th. So it's their Valentine's Day present to us.
You know, 5 days after the recording of the show.
Well, you know, it's how it works. We have new alternate leaders, 2 for Egypt and 1 for Mali. I think it's Sundiata Keita or something like that for Mali.
Something like that. I don't know how to pronounce those, because when you listen to him in the first look, I think he doesn't speak Arabic, so I am not confident on the pronunciation of his name.
Well, I do know how to say Ramesses and Cleopatra.
yeah
and it's Ptolemaic Cleopatra.
That one, the P is silent.
Yeah,
so
Ptolemaic.
Patui,
whatever. There's some faucet company that starts like that, too.
Well, it makes sense, because that's a Greek root word. So we finally have a Greek Cleopatra, which is appropriate.
Yeah, we kind of got started into discussion of it before we got started streaming about it. Does she actually look different? I'm like, yeah, because she doesn't have that gigantic pharaoh collar type thing on her anymore.
Yeah.
And she's got more... She really is more Greek-styled here than Egyptian-styled. And as usual, we don't really know what they're going to get.
I don't know.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, it's just 5 days out. We still don't know who they're going to be like. It's like, thanks?
And there was a first look for Keita. I'm going to call him Keita because that's what I know those vowels to make. They made a first look, and it was him doing some animations and a quote, and that was it. And I remember back in the days when we used to get first looks that actually gave us, you know,
information about the leaders we were getting, but I guess the press team...
I'm in the second look now.
The press team is all busy doing their stuff for Midnight Suns, I guess.
Yeah, with Cleopatra, I wonder if it's going to go more towards learning and things like that. She was actually very well educated.
Yeah.
That doesn't come across in a lot of things that feature Cleopatra as a character, but...
Yeah, Cleopatra is woefully misrepresented a lot of times.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember, because we've had Ramses before, and I don't remember what the difference was in other games between him and Cleopatra.
Well, in Sith War, it was their traits.
Yeah, but what were the traits?
I believe she was spiritual creative, and he was industrious spiritual.
Okay, so one or both of them may have a religious bias they didn't have previously. That's possible. Yeah.
I don't think so, because ancient Egyptian religion is not well represented in Civ, so it would be weird to make them, like, religious players, because I don't think there's an option to pick ancient Egyptian religion in the religion picker when you found one.
Now that you mention it, that's odd. I think they could have thrown something like that in there.
Well, they added...
one of the icons you can pick or whatever.
I'm sure you can choose an Egyptian god as one of the names you pick for one of the astrological symbols they have up there.
Yeah.
I don't think there's a sun one, though. And there's definitely not a pharaoh one.
I'm just waiting for them to add the paradox logo as one of the symbols for your religion.
Why would they do that?
Because it would be really entertaining.
This is Firaxis, though.
I know.
Firaxis already puts their symbol in places. They could have put it in there, I guess, but...
Oh, yeah. I mean, they should definitely put their own symbol in, but if they put the Paradox logo, that would just be absolute trolling.
Very true. I wonder if the Leader Scavenger Hunt people have been finding the Firaxis swirl on all these new leaders. I haven't seen a thread about that. Looking at the pictures, it looks like it might be blocked by the text. Great.
Yeah.
Did the Egyptian pharaohs shave their heads? Is that why Ramses is bald?
I don't know. I don't think we actually know, because they could have done that in the burial prep and we never know if they had hair in life or not. That just, it's easier to draw them with their special crowns in the different depictions instead of trying to put hair, you know?
Oh, of course. I type in pharaoh's hair and I get Yugi's hair from Japan. I mean, yeah, technically that is a pharaoh with hair, but...
And I guess it's popular enough that would be high in the search results. It makes sense that you'd get that, but it's funny.
Everyone's favorite character is the nameless pharaoh, so... I know that in ancient Rome, hair was cut short because of lice, so maybe it was similar in Egypt? Okay, Egyptian hairstyles, ancient Egypt. Children were expected to shave off their head other than an S-shaped lock. Men had their hair completely cut off or shaved in most cases. Women's hairstyles kept short hair, but this faded and long curly plaited hair became more popular. The poor didn't have any money to pay for expensive or good-looking ornament for their hair, so they would decorate their hair with fish. Amulets of fish, hair rings, and clasps. Okay, so since the pharaoh was a man, we can was almost always, or at least as far as we know, always a man, they were bald.
Hmm.
But they had elaborate long wigs, apparently. Anyway, back to Civ.
Ancient hair brought to you by... I wish they would give us more information, but hey, by the time you hear this, you'll probably know, because you'll be playing them.
Yep, well, we'll find out sooner or later. So I guess moving on then, we have a fairly lengthy article. It's by the Digital Antiquarian about sequels and strategy gaming. And this is part one. My gosh. I read through some of this, but a lot of it's just the history of how sequels got started and such, and in Civ in particular.
I
don't know if there's something you wanted to emphasize here. I have my own opinions on on the sequel stuff, but...
The way that this article is structured is trying to make a point about how there are different kinds of sequels in gaming, specifically that Civilization is a mechanics-based sequel rather than a story-based sequel.
Yeah, well, by necessity, though. And that's going to be true in a lot of games, unless there's, like, a contiguous story that was told, like, from like from a book or something, adapted into a game, or it's that kind of structure where a character actually goes through progression, has development or whatnot, and then you do a sequel. Well, it would be pretty off-putting, as we've observed numerous times throughout, well, not just gaming, but media in general, to have that character's growth slash whatever destroyed in the sequel for whatever reason. And so you'd actually want to see that those characters progress, or at least be where they were when you left off. But there's nothing like that in a Civ game, because you're taking nations from the start to a finish in a playthrough, and there's no canonical ending, so to speak. So yeah, it has to be mechanics-based sequels, and that would be true for most stuff. Like, if you have a roguelike with random characters and you want to do a sequel, it's going to be the same thing. It has to be mechanics-based.
Yes.
Yeah, well, yeah, and so all the RPGs are a story-based one, because you're either continuing that story or the story of other characters in the same universe. You know.
I mean, or you could go the Final Fantasy route and just, like, there's no reference to the previous characters whatsoever. All your characters are new.
There's little elements of things that are familiar from game to game, but the settings are vary wildly and the characters in the story do.
Yeah, but I would argue that those are therefore much closer to mechanics-based sequels than story-based, because you're not continuing the story. It's not like you go from Final Fantasy VII to VIII, and it's like, oh, okay, yeah. This is the world that happened as a result of in the previous game, or like, you know, you don't have Cloud in the game at all, or whatever.
And the closest you'd get to a story continuation in Civ is if you won as the Alpha Centauri thing, and then you went and played some other colonization type of game where you were colonizing in space.
Yeah.
Sort of continuing your story, but you can't really properly continue the story.
A great without mistake was not doing World Conquest. Now you have competitors there too. Unfortunate.
I found it amusing that the author thought that Civ 1 was a better game. I'm just like, really?
Yeah, I don't
know. How does that work?
I like how some of the comments immediately go to like being gamey versus doing like making your own story up or whatever. Well, waste no time, I swear.
Historical games are always about role play or mechanics, and you fall on one side or the other. We know which side you fall on.
Yep.
So
I'm calling you out, random internet people.
I see both sides, but I also don't care. So it's like, you know, I like role playing, but at the same time, I'm not going to role play for the sake of losing. So.
Well, that's where I actually get into some points of contention, though. It's because it's not just that other people are enjoying the game differently. They are advocating for changes that sometimes get implemented into the game that reduce agency for players who are actually interacting with the mechanics. Even as they themselves don't interact with the mechanics well, don't understand that side of the game too well, and then they nevertheless, because even as they're quote-unquote role-playing, they still get upset when they lose. Like, It's still generates a story, right? But it's not the story they wanted. So now they want the mechanics to conform to whatever outcome they're picturing in their head, which is going to be different for different people necessarily. You know, everyone's making their own story ultimately. And that's not how you create good mechanics. It's not how you make a functional game. And yes, I've actually observed these argumentative effects get implemented into a game. I'll just use E4 as an example and make the game worse as a consequence of doing so. And it's annoying. So there are some harmful effects, but only if the devs listen, I guess.
Yeah. Which I guess is more common nowadays than it was back then.
Well, yeah. There's no time for the feedback to go back to the devs to like make the game differently through patches that way. You couldn't even do patches that way.
But yeah, this is an interesting read if you have not read it. Well, might be the most obvious thing I've ever said.
It also depends how much you're into the history of these things being developed, because they do go into a fair amount of detail here.
Yeah, it talks about how Brian Reynolds wanted the cheat menu because the cheat menu was fun.
Well, it is fun to have the cheat codes available that after you've beaten the game at some point and you can just go through. And sometimes in modern games, it helps to have the cheat menus available because sometimes the game glitches in weird ways they couldn't have predicted. And that way you can get back on track with your actual game.
Yes.
What would we do without the ability to toggle clipping on and off in a Bethesda game, for example?
Yeah,
oops, or I'm stuck like, in the scenery again.
Playing modded stuff and some things don't go the way anybody envisioned. It's nice to have the console for that. Especially if it's your only means of continuing the game without it crashing, for example. Then it's really, really nice to have the console to make sure that the check that causes the crash isn't done because the stuff isn't there or whatever. It's nice to have workarounds like that.
I do appreciate the occasional game now and then that I see that actually has unstuck in the main menu. Like, thank you, because you knew your scenery was going to be glitchy.
And that's a Bethesda game.
Well, it happens in other games.
Oh, shoot. I got to figure out what the next topic is. Modern forts! So, there's a thread. Is it actually a thread, or is it on Reddit? No, it's on Reddit, because...
It looks like a Civ thread to me. At least put the link.
That's the wrong one. I have it labeled wrong. Okay. In my head. So the question that Lone Cat Neko Frady, asks is Kenmen Fortress of Taiwan the perfect example of a modern fortress? And overall louts about how...
Layouts.
Okay, so they've got a letter. How does it look like? Also, how did it evolve from the old medieval star fort and also return to medieval castle made entirely with ferrocrete? I guess somebody is... Is ferrocrete actually a thing or is it a sci-fi thing?
Isn't that just like concrete with rebar or...
I don't think
I'm not familiar with the term, but...
I've never...
If I heard that hearing that term for the first time, that's what it makes me think of, is concrete reinforced with rebar. Which is probably not technically wrong. There's got to be some iron in the rebar.
Well, it's
not pure iron, but there's some.
It's a word I often hear in contexts, including the word plasteel. So I always assume that is a science fiction type word, but maybe it's not. I don't know.
I mean, you can also put like plastics into crap. And then it's like, it's not what the game means, but it's sort of, you can kind of see where they're coming from and making the term, so to speak.
Yeah. Are we still talking about the word?
There's no Rimworld plasteel, but you can like mix plastic and steel in your design of materials.
Yeah. Anyway, back to the actual fort. There's a picture here of a fort. It is painted with what looks like old style camouflage, and it's like it looks like more like a pillbox than like a giant fort. And the conversation basically goes along the line that with rifled artillery, star forts are useless because they can just be blown up. So modern forts tend to be places that are largely underground or hidden in piles of rubble or mostly designed for the protection against aerial weapons rather than artillery, which means they're mostly underground. Examples.
Actually, the first thing that came to mind when I read modern fort is the trench.
Well, yeah. They're talking about underground. An underground fortress would be something like NORAD in Colorado Springs, or
Cheyenne Mountain thing.
Yeah, or like that. Azov steel plant that kind of got completely surrounded by the Russians earlier last year in Mariupol, is that what it was called? But the idea that that kind of fortification is a trench is also mentioned.
I looked it up on Wiki, by the way. Apparently, ferrocement is exactly what I thought it was. It's just like you put metal objects like rebar into the cement as you're pouring it so that it's stronger than it ordinarily would be. Like, there's no like sci-fi element here. This is just commonly done stuff. So there you go. Sorry to derail that, but that was interesting.
It's okay. But yeah, entrenchments and such can be considered modern forts. But I think the fact that we even have forts in the modern era on the Civ map might be an anachronism. Can you still build fortresses later in the game with military engineers?
I think so.
Yeah. I think I'm pretty sure.
Like, from a gameplay point of view, it does definitely have a reason to exist.
Well, it lets you do it, but it's also not as good as it used to be in earlier eras because, like, you have planes that can hit the target and you have longer ranged artillery than was available in previous eras, up to 4 with the promotion and the the flight support. So, like, a lot more things can hit the target in a fortress in the late game than the early game, which is not, I mean, it's crude, but it's a pretty good approximation of why they're less effective in modern times, is that things can more effectively hit you even if you're in the fort. So, I think it's fine.
You might slow down the advancing army, but they can also in turn send drones or airstrikes or whatever right over your fortress, and then, oh, look, you don't have one anymore.
Yeah, or just kill the unit inside regardless pretty easily. I don't know. Like, there are things that militaries do to make it harder to pick them off if they're staying in a spot. But it's not like it's not the same amount of protection as a medieval castle was in the medieval era.
It's kind of hard to have that level of protection in today's world unless you're literally underground in an anti-nuclear bunker or something.
Well, even then, it's probably not as safe, relatively speaking.
That's why they came up with bunker busters.
I mean, you're probably not coming out of it alive if a nuke does go off, but...
I mean, you could probably just damage any potential entry point sufficiently that it would be difficult to leave.
Yeah, I don't want to think about that. Being buried alive is a very primal fear.
But you'd have plenty of time to think about it because those bunkers that's probably have why plenty it's of resources.
So, that's why it's so primal.
Oh, diplomacy changes. Yes. Which one is the link for the? Oh, there it is. Reddit thread. What would be the diplomatic changes and mechanics they would like to see in the next Civ game? So, example, better call to arms mechanics. You know, if I'm doing an allies defensive war, it shouldn't be the equivalent to me declaring war on the attacking civilization and all its allies.
I think the thing he was talking about was, if you have a defensive pact and an alliance of enemies are attacking your defensive pact partner, you only declare war on the one who declared war on him directly first. So once you're already at war, I think the other civs don't get the same protection. You don't get the same, this was a defensive war, modifiers with the rest of the world if multiple people are attacking you. You have to declare on them individually.
Oh, so it's, okay.
So it's not like, how it would really work where, oh, you have a defensive pact with this country, and then an alliance declares a war on them, and then you are automatically at war with the alliance. No, you're only at war. You're only at war with the attacker.
Yeah, that's jank.
Yeah.
Some people want them to draw inspiration from beyond the sword because they want capitulation, vassalage. Oh, Phil would be great with that. Granting independence to overseas territories.
Well, now, do you mean diplovassal or war vassal? Because those were very different in terms of how I experienced them in Civ 4.
They were specific on that one.
Yeah. I mean, you can make vassals a functional mechanic, or you can make it awful. So I'm not necessarily opposed to the turn of vassals. I'll just put it that way. But I'm also, I would have some caution.
Yeah, further down, someone would like to see diplomatic favor not be a currency like gold thing, which I think can be too easily abused, and for it said to be as a scale between different nations that, you know, like if you've been trading and stuff for a long time, it slowly built up the favor, and you're like, I mean, we have that in terms of whether they decide whether they're friendly or not friendly with us, but I guess they want to actually see a scale of how their relations are right now. You know, like you start at neutral, and depending on your actions, it goes up into get along better territory. And the AI can still also lie to you and say, oh, we love you, we absolutely do, and then turn around and stab you in the face.
Make Dido deceptive. Sorry. Although an old joke from Civ 5.
Ultimately, players would be able to figure it out. And like Civ 4 just straight up gave you a numerical value that you could work with, so there's that as well.
Yeah. And then also some better ways to do demands and things. You know, they added a couple of other things like, stop attacking that city state, take your envoys elsewhere. That would be great. I mean, of course, we always have to move your troops off my border, since they ask us that all the time. Why can't we ask the reverse? And also the timeline on the moving your troops. It's like, yeah, sometimes you can't move them off the next turn, and then they're like, oh my god, you didn't move it two turns later. It's like, have you seen the terrain around your quarters? I'm not the answer. I can't move your mountains.
After seeing this, that I did actually respond in it, and I just said, I want whatever behaviors by AI to align to the incentives of the game, so that they're not like throwing just because they like you, for example, and that you can make incentives align. I don't think that's impossible, but it will result in a different game than we have now. So yeah, like, it's kind of a pipe dream, and we've talked about it before, especially with Jason around, but I'd like to see that built into diplomacy so that there's more incentive to work together. Or barring that, have the transactions make sense in the context of like you're trading with this person so that you both have an advantage that the remaining civs don't get as a result of the trade. So that you're increasing your odds and the odds of one other opponent at the expense of everybody else's odds in principle.
Yeah, even if you were at max friendliness with a country, that doesn't mean they should let us walk all over them in a deal.
But that does imply things like the religious victory condition would be close to impossible without fighting. And a lot of people wouldn't be okay with that. So
yeah,
you would have to rework a lot of mechanics in the game in addition to reworking how diplomacy works so that they're aligned to each other. And I don't think you could do it by just changing the mechanics or just changing the diplomacy. That said, we're talking about what will almost certainly be like stuff for a new Civ game. Like Civ 6 is pretty late in its development cycle. So total reworks of these systems is par for the course to some degree. I'm not holding my breath, but that is what I would like to see when it comes to Diplo.
I think we can all agree that the stuff that was added in Beyond Earth Rising Tide was pretty good. Maybe tweak that a little bit, but the idea of having diplomacy not based entirely on one factor of a relationship helps.
Oh, the respect thing versus the fear thing?
Yeah. We respect you as we respect your decisions, but we also have respect for your military. So those two things have to balance together to make something that works. That way it's not like, oh, you have a huge military and we're afraid of you, even though we're allies. Like happened in Civ 5 sometimes. Basically, just add a bunch of the stuff from other Civ games that we had. Let us trade maps.
Oh god, yes, please.
Let us trade only territory maps. Let us trade all but our territory maps. You know, let us have some granularity in what we show. You know, Civ 3 let us do that.
You don't need to see where all my cities are, but I can tell you whether there's here be dragons on the other side of me.
Yeah. Also, can you let us trade contact with other Civs?
Oh yeah, that was always a good one.
That was something that I liked in Civ 3, but I can't see since Civ 3. So why are countries unable to facilitate the greeting of two nations within themselves? I mean, how many times have war parties come together in Paris to settle a war? How many treaties of Paris are there? I think there's more than 20 that I know of.
Plus, you would just have some awareness of another civilization based on your interactions with one, if they're extensive interactions. And that is somewhat abstracted by trading with them, so it makes sense.
Yeah, and you know, it would be something for the AI. They could ask you, hey, I've heard of this Civ. Can you tell me where they are?
Or maybe just give us contact, because maybe you don't want them to know where they are, but you'd like to talk to them.
Yeah, I've heard rumors through the trade routes of this other civilization. Do you know I could contact them for their goods?
Maybe trade embargo stuff. How about give us a robust system for creating formal multi-part alliances? You know, let us have the analog of like NATO or something like that in a Civ game, because you can't tell me that that's not a relevant thing in today's world now.
Maybe, but how would that play with victory conditions? Because remember, today's world does not have victory conditions the same way Civ has them.
I think we could argue it does, but
well, they're not the same as Civ.
No, they're not. Thankfully, they're not. But I don't know. I think if you make a permanent, you should have permanent alliance type things. Like I'm pretty sure that NATO is a permanent alliance.
I don't think so.
Not in the terms that Civ 4 used it, but I can't imagine. Well, that's a whole other topic. But if we returned permanent alliances, maybe make permanent alliances available between more than just two people.
So I'm pretty sure the HRE still had a longer run than NATO.
Yes, it did. But also, NATO is not a federated empire, and the HRE is not an alliance. So
I'm just saying, you're betting against history. I know we're a bit off topic, but yeah.
There was a fun example somebody gave in the thread about Peter apparently got mad because their holy city converted. They're like, yeah, but that's because you sent your debater into my apostle, and whoops, your city converted. That's not my fault, but no, you're going to declare a religious emergency and a war on me because of something you did. Although, you know, in real life, that could probably happen.
Yes, it could.
It's all bait. You're using the mechanics to your advantage. Get the religious emergency.
Oh, yeah. Then you wouldn't have the...
The great casus belli.
Yeah, you wouldn't have the you wouldn't have the grievances against you because they declared war on you instead of the other way around.
Yeah.
Huh.
I wish the emergency mechanic was a little bit more fleshed out, but I don't know how you
like
do
when
it.
I trigger one because it makes the loyalty in the target city much stronger.
Yeah, that's... It's like whenever there's an emergency, whenever we're playing a multiplayer game in co-op, which happens less regularly now than it did before, for me at least, but you can, just as the human players, even if you're in co-op, always vote for the emergency, because the losing players don't actually lose anything, and the winner gets extra stuff if they win the thing. And most of the AI won't join it because they're too busy being lazy butts. So most of the time you're like, oh, well, if you can forego trade routes to another player and just not fight each other, that's a bonus for the trigger of the event and nobody else loses anything, which is just a net positive for defeating the AI.
Yeah, in the co-op game, it's always like, do you want the emergency or not so you can take advantage of it? Nobody's really that concerned about the AI actually coming over and fulfilling the emergency.
It's like, oh, one of the AIs is fighting me. That's okay. I was fighting them anyway. Or getting ready to.
Yeah.
And then another thing you can do if you're, like, having a faux war with one of your allies is, let's just have gladiatorial games where we put our units right next to each other and just fight back and forth and let them heal up and fight back and forth and farm experience.
Takes too long. But it is an option.
Well, you have to be at war for 25 turns in an emergency, so.
Yeah, but I want to be using my units to, like, gain tangible benefit beyond just XP.
Sometimes the situation doesn't allow that in Civ.
Yeah, or you're, like, done, so you might as well do something on your turns, I guess.
Well, there are also situations where, okay, I'm not going to attack Shaka in the medieval era, because that would be stupid.
Good win.
Well, yes, you could win, but it would be much more expensive than it needed to be.
Hmm.
But back to diplomacy. Does anybody else have any other ideas? Thoughts? Opinions? Desires?
You know what? We need our coalitions.
I would kind of be okay with that if it was done properly, but because it's a game, it probably wouldn't be.
Oh, you meant, like, good thoughts and opinions? And well, stuff I actually believe. Okay, well...
One could argue that the emergency that causes everybody to declare war on you to fix the fact that you've captured too many capitals is a coalition situation, but the AI just doesn't react to it well. Maybe there should be a little bit more emphasis on joining emergencies like that, even if you're not super hateful toward that player.
Or if it's taking place next to your borders, you have an interest in it, even if you didn't really want to...
Yeah.
Even if you're allied to the superpower, you have an interest in the superpower not getting more powerful than you.
Yeah, or like winning the game outright before you can do anything.
Yeah, abusing their authority one way or the other.
And, you know, maybe we need a diplomatic reputation thing.
Somebody suggested something like that further back up in the thread. That it was like, if you've been dealing with this Civ for a while and they keep breaking their promises, then... you're going to make it more costly for them just as a baseline to even try and have a peaceful solution, because we know you're not going to do it.
Well, there's already sort of something like that, because if you break your expansion promise, for instance, it will come up and say they forgot your thing. They forgot your offense. Because this game does take place on a much longer scale than some of the other games that have diplomatic reputation style stuff. But
yeah, it didn't seem like that person... I think wanted it to work both ways, that they would actually make the player have to agree to a harsher deal if they kept repeatedly breaking promises. So it wasn't one-sided in that sense.
I would like the AI to not make stupid deals with the player that the player can immediately break. Like, maybe the AI should be maybe just a little bit smarter. Oh, look, that's that again. Came up yet again.
All right, break out the machine learning. Let's go.
We just
yeah, that's about the right response. That's about the right response to what I said.
I mean, I'm excusing the whole problem that we're calling this an AI when it's not really an AI. It's a behavior script, but
I mean, that's the AI has been shorthand for that for most of our lifetimes.
And
it's not going to change.
I think it needs to change because we're getting into the realm of, okay, now there's machine learning models that are being called AI, and people are treating them like they're actually thinking when they're spewing out their randomly generated or their specifically generated text. And the average person is going to be like, okay, so there's an AI that does all my work for me. And it's like, no, it's not an AI. It's not aware of itself. It's not thinking when it's doing
Nobody really, at least up until now, when you hear AI in the context of games, people don't think, oh, this is an intelligent being making decisions like a human would make them. I mean, some people act that way in the moment. Get angry with like the leader head or whatever. But I don't think too many people really believe that this is acting like a person and it isn't just a computer script that is responding to what's happening in the game.
Well, I'm not talking about the gaming side. I'm talking about, you know, ChatGPT is now a thing that the public is aware of. And people are going to start calling that an AI when it is very much not an AI.
Well, it depends on your definition of AI. Remember, if you're using the definition of AI as in, like, Montezuma in Civ 4, if that's an AI, I don't think it's unreasonable to put the ChatGPT in the same bin as Montezuma from Civ 4.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm saying. We shouldn't call it that.
Or AI could just mean what it has meant up until now. And if we actually design a self-aware / thinking machine, we can come up with another term for that because we don't have too many of those yet, to put it mildly.
At this point, the various other Civs when you're playing the game are basically a set of algorithms that have a face and a character to them that you can get mad at.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
When
we're
I look,
humans, we like to anthropomorphize. Treat everything as human.
Anthropomorphize. That was a word that I learned from my grandpa when I was 10, because he worked in the zoo industry, and he had a very strong opinion about people who think that animals have similar rights to humans, because you can't project a human emotion onto an animal and expect it to make sense. Not that you should treat animals like crap, but
no,
there's a reason why they're not human, and it's not because I guess it is because they're not human, but
yeah, well, that the rationale for that probably tracks to machine algorithms and maybe even to intelligent machines, although you'd worry a bit more about those in terms of how you interact with them, at least.
Yeah, I know it's...
Once they exist, that is. Because that right now they do not. But once they exist...
As far as we know...
You probably don't want to screw the super intelligence. And you probably can't anyway.
Well...
I prefer the American defense against nuclear-powered AI, which is... Make sure that all the stuff that powers the nukes is on ancient computers that require floppy disks to operate.
Air-gapped, too.
Well, yeah, that's the idea. Like, if you're an AI, sure, you can get onto a machine that's really old, but if you don't have the floppy disk, it's not going to work.
Because it's a literal physical key card, in a sense.
Yeah.
I'm sure the AI could find other ways of getting what it wants than nukes.
I mean, it would still be able to coerce humans to do its bidding.
Yeah,
but...
I was going to... Yeah.
Yeah.
But we're also assuming that any given AI would automatically be hostile.
There is some concern over that because a lot of terminal goals have convergent instrumental goals. Like making yourself more powerful is generally useful if you have any goal. So the AI, in the process of making its own influence stronger and reducing the influence of factors it can't control, would have incentive to screw with humans. Maybe not like species ending screw, although it might, but even if it doesn't, like it would still be a very costly problem. You know, even if it's not a civilization ending problem, it would be extremely costly to have a misaligned AI, like take over your power grid or whatever.
Well, I feel like if it took over the power grid and shut it down, it would kill itself, but
Well, I didn't say it would shut it down.
Yeah, we didn't say it was going to shut it down, but it might mess with it. Oh, these people aren't doing the right thing and doing all the recycling. Well, no power for you. Something crazy, you know.
Yeah, or it might depower things with disregard for human life because it has other goals than that. Or it only regards some human life as sufficiently worthwhile, etc.
Yeah.
Because of how it's tuned.
It and how they define human, you could really get in trouble there.
Oh, yeah.
Please, no utilitarians making AIs, please.
People who have been working on this for a while have struggled very severely with just aligning an AI to do to have the same values as what they intend to put in. Like, not even, this isn't even a question of like a bad actor making a super AI. It is apparently extremely difficult just to make the AI consistent with what you personally want the AI to do.
Yeah,
if
it is sentient, it can make its own decisions, which means
you're programming a value system into it from the start, right?
Yeah,
but it's pretty difficult to do that.
You would definitely want to do that, otherwise, well.
Yeah, and it's turning out that it's extremely hard and maybe not solvable. We'll see.
I don't know if
trying to make an AI 3 laws compliant, like from the Asimov books, is actually a lot harder than it seems.
Yeah. To put it mildly, yes.
Well, and did the 3 laws not work out totally? So,
well, there was
even in the books they didn't, but
it's very strict, and depending on the sophistication of the AI, it could be very strict interpretation of it.
Yeah,
the books were hand waving a lot of steps anyway because they were trying to generate a story, not show you what that programming looks like and what the behaviors are as a result of it.
Yeah, and then you have eventually down the line, one of the robots has basically sort of a malfunction and manages to create a zeroth law, you know, to put humanity first instead of individual humans. And it's like, so how long is it going to take before any AI we create starts making its own laws? Yeah, exactly.
Well, I think it'll be the moment it can make its own decisions.
Yeah.
To an extent.
Anyway, we are way off topic.
If you have a value system, like modifications to your value system are pretty low on your evaluation of your value system. So it'll do like some changes probably, but it's hard to predict what those would be. And it's very, very likely that it would interfere with any attempts to update its values. One of the YouTube videos I watched on this was like, here, I'll offer you a pill that makes you want to kill your kids and be happy with that. Well, the current you would probably fight pretty strongly against that, wouldn't you?
Yes.
And so you would expect the machine whose values its current systems very highly to also resist being given a pill that makes it no longer value what it currently values.
Your
problem.
Do that, Dave.
Yeah. Okay, speaking of machines, we now have the duality of man. No, this is a Reddit post about special units in Civ 6. Like, the original image is a side-by-side post of carriers might be the most useless unit in the game, and absolutely carriers are busted as hell, is this topic in a nutshell, so to speak. And then a lot of the discussion on the thread is actually about spec ops rather than carriers.
And skirmishers.
And skirmishers. Because carriers, like, they have a very obvious purpose, and if you are not fighting on the water at all, then they are pretty useless. And if you want to multiply the amount of power you can bring on the water, then they are very useful because you can fit more stuff into the same space. So
I think
they're a little easier than the other ones.
I learned in this thread that carriers can take cities and that it gives them a promotion.
Oh. I don't get to play with carriers very often, so I hadn't tried that, but I could see myself having tried that in a desperation when the city is down to a sliver and I've thrown everything else at it. Ah, just throw the carrier in!
Yeah, they have combat strength.
And they're melee.
Yeah. Melee. I just don't generally think of a carrier as an assault unit. I think of the planes on it as the assault part of it.
I'm just imagining the USS JF, or the USS Gerald R. Ford, which is a super carrier that is bigger than the usual super carriers. It's our newest one. And it's just sailing up the river in some city, taking the city. And we're talking about a ship that is so big that I don't think it could sail up the Mississippi, personally. But
if you think about it carefully, it's really funny to picture literally any naval unit by itself capturing a city.
Like, what, did the sailors all jump off and say, you know?
I mean, presumably that's how it's being done. The people on the ship are getting off the ship and walking into the city. Because otherwise,
walk right up to City Hall. This is our city now, buddy.
Otherwise, you have like boats on wheels going through the streets or something. I don't know how this works. So, yeah, in that sense, I guess a carrier is as realistic as any other naval unit taking a city. Because you just take the people on the boat and walk them into the city.
On further thought, it actually makes more sense for it to be a carrier than any other ship, because a carrier has the most crew.
Yeah.
They're like, what, 6,000 to 8,000 crew members on a carrier, so...
Yeah, that's true. 6,000 to 8,000 armed soldiers could probably do a pretty good job of screwing up a city.
Well, most of them aren't armed all the time, at least. There's...
Yeah, yeah, I'm sure they could figure it out, though.
They're sailors, but I'm sure they've been trained how to use a gun.
Yeah.
Yes.
I don't think they let too many people who have not gone through basic training on the high-cost military vessels. Probably not. So yeah, you also have scoot and shoot with like spec ops and stuff, but they're not great units. People have pointed out that since you start with a scout, then you might have one.
Well, theoretically, if you get it to 3 promotions and upgrade it to the spec ops, it would be a useful unit. And then other people are like, maybe, but it needs 3 promotions to do what some of the other light infantry can do easily. So
yeah, or cavalry. Can also take over a lot of that role, because they also can hit and move, and they are also very fast units.
The exception being the skirmisher, because it also has a ranged unit, and a ranged attack and a melee attack.
Yeah. Even then, by the time, I don't know, it's just, they don't do that much damage, and they take up space.
Take up maintenance cost.
I mean, that too. You can usually find a way to pay for your armies, but you want the armies that you're sending to be effective, for the production cost and at fighting the enemy units in cities. And these units don't strike me as particularly valuable at any point in the game in offensive operations against the AI. And that said, if I have like a scout with a bunch of promotions, I mean, okay, sure, I might upgrade it and have it shoot the enemy once or something and get out of the way. It's not how it usually happens with my scouts. Usually they get trapped in like some AI border nonsense or picked off.
Yeah, that one hex they haven't taken over yet, but it's in the middle of their empire.
Yeah.
Oh, I can't move.
Yeah, so out of all these units, I'm probably most likely to use carriers. The paradropping thing is interesting, too. Paradrop used to be way more valuable because you couldn't use, like, hostile roads, and units weren't as fast. Like, even tanks were 2-move in Civ 4 relative to, like, you know, like a 1-move infantry, and that's other than like helicopters, which couldn't take cities, that's as fast as you were getting. And it, like, the promotion to use hostile roads was extremely expensive.
Yeah, it was like 4th level, wasn't it?
Yeah, like you basically weren't going to get a unit there. And because units could, there was no like hit point system. So you, in terms of like in between fights, like every combat resulted in somebody dying. There was no real way to get your units that highly promoted. So, like, you would paradrop next to a city and take it after clearing out the units. It's pretty valuable. In Civ 6, you have, like, tremendous damage capability from range. You have tons of units, including basic infantry, that can pretty well run from one city to the other by, like, the late mid-game. There's no... Like, paratroopers are just not as valuable in the context of that scenario. If you can just take your random unit and smash it into the city whenever you want from, like, outside the city's shooting range, there's no real benefit to having a paratrooper drop down. And now they don't even melee, so, I don't know, these spec ops things.
Well, part of it might be a reaction to the fact that the original spec ops unit leveled up into, or improved in, or whatever the word is, upgraded to the XCOM, which was a paratrooper that was very strong and had no limit to its deployment. So it was just like, oh, hey, 6 XCOMs now surround all your cities. And stealth bombers are nuking the planet as we speak. You have no chance.
I would imagine anybody with access to that much could have won the game sooner, though, rather than doing that.
Depends. If you're doing, like, a tech rush type thing, you might out-tech your ability to upgrade your units.
Well, yeah, but then you don't have 6 spec ops per city with a bunch of bombers backing them if you've out-teched your production to that extent. You then need to build that crap.
Yeah. I keep forgetting that the game is played to be won rather than to just style on other players.
I mean, people can play how they want, but the mechanics and rules place incentives differently. For example, you might have wanted to conquer some of those cities earlier, so you had the production to produce some of these XCOM units, and therefore have all this available sooner than you ultimately did.
Well, yeah.
Even in the context of Civ 5, which penalized you for expanding, that was probably true. If you were going to be that far ahead in tech, and you actually wanted to have, like, I don't know, 15 XCOM or 20-some XCOM, whatever, then you probably wanted more production by then.
Yeah, but there also weren't army units back then, and also, yeah. I'm mostly playing in the mind, in the theater of ideas now, because I rarely played games to that point. I would always win before then, but...
Yeah, well, that's kind of by design.
Yeah. Like, yeah, you can have all these nice units after it's too late to matter.
Or it'll break a stalemate. And that was the point of nukes in Civ 4, too, in the way they were implemented. Because you there's no amount of stacking, and, like, SDI only did so much, whereby, like, you would be safe against TAC nukes. You would just lose everything. There's no way to defend that.
Did SDI even work against tactical nukes?
A percentage of the time. I think it was, I forget the odds, but like, you're like 2/3 to get through with a TAC nuke, and only like 1/4 to get through with an ICBM or something.
Okay, that makes more sense. Because I remember...
Don't hold me to these percentages, but the TAC nukes were significantly better at getting through SDI. And I think better than 50% for sure.
I never used nukes when I played Civ 4 because I was a kid and nukes are bad.
Nukes are very bad for the target of the nuke. Nukes are extremely bad for stacks.
Yeah. Remember.
You went from, like, struggling against enormous production values and, like, hundreds and hundreds of units to, if you wanted to build up the attack nukes in advance, you could nuke down superpowers to having no military in a single turn and, like, conquer either all of their cities or all but, like, a couple of their cities before they got to move.
Yeah.
Like, so that's very much a mechanic in the game that is designed, very clearly designed, to break whatever paradigm was established previously.
Well, they kind of did nationally, too. Internationally.
Yeah.
But remember, you're also talking to somebody whose first game of Civ 4 ended in a loss on Settler, and the loss was a science victory. So, I wasn't exactly...
Culture.
Well, back during Civ 4, I was not an expert player. I'm still not, but I was even less of an expert player then.
Yeah, I was pretty bad in Civ 4. Because I was playing on, like, Settler or whatever when I did my first Civ 4 game, and I won Culture, but it was awful. Absolutely awful.
I didn't win a game above Noble until Civ 5 when I started playing on Emperor.
Yeah.
And then I stopped playing on that level because I was just like, no, this isn't fun.
I got to Monarch pretty fast in Civ 4 once I started, like, posting on Civ Fanatics, learning stuff, whatever. After that, it started taking work. I had to actually work to improve.
Most of my learning about Civ Tactics came from Polycast, actually, back when I was listening to it as a kid.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for pointing that out.
You're making this all feel old now. This podcast started when I was in 10th grade, so...
Well, at least you were a teenage kid and not a kid.
Yeah.
Then I'd feel older.
Actually, I take that back. I was a junior in high school, because Civ 4 came out when I was in 10th grade. And then Polycast was a year later, after Warlords.
I played Civ 4 in grad school, although I didn't get it right when it came out, so.
Okay, so our last topic for today, as we continue on the long epic of the We Don't Want Your Stupid Launcher, this is... This is, what is it, part 8 of the We Don't Want Your Stupid Launcher garbage. It turns out that if you are using the 2K launcher to launch Midnight Suns, which is the new Firaxis game, no, the Marvel game, you can significantly reduce game stuttering and boost your FPS by disabling the 2K launcher. Which I don't think anybody is surprised by, because why would... First of all, why is the launcher still active while the game is running?
Yeah, that's incredibly obnoxious.
Second, why do we need it? We've got Steam. Steam does all the stuff the launcher does, and better, already.
Well, I think when we discussed this before, it's Because then 2K gets to push ads at us through the launcher.
Yeah, and harvest our data and all that garbage. Yeah. But
in addition to all these like bad faith things initially, it's just disgusting that they're running it when it's not even doing any of that. Well, I guess it's probably still pulling your data or whatever.
Oh, absolutely.
But you could do that with the game. Like, there's even if you have like 100% evil intentions, there's no reason to implement a launcher in a way that it sacrifices game performance. It's idiotic.
It's not, and it's like, okay, not only is it bad, it is astonishingly bad.
Yeah.
If you take a look at the actual data that people have noticed or have looked up and tested for, like, if you're running on super high quality with the launcher running on the most modern technology, I think, RTX 390, Core i9, 10900, 32 gigs of RAM, and at 1440p, with all the extra options turned on, which is a pretty hefty tech budget. That's a lot of stuff to go on, and it's a very expensive computer. The average frame rate is like 90 frames per second, and then they disabled the launcher, and it was 146 frames per second.
Whoa.
So,
you gain another, I can't do math right now. That's a lot of gain for disabling a launcher.
It's a 62% improvement. And I didn't do the math myself. It's in the article.
Oh, okay. So I was going to say, hold up. Yeah, that's ridiculous. It should not be bogging you down that much, even if it's collecting stuff in the background. Like, what the hell else is that doing?
I wonder if it's possible to do like an analysis of what the actual launcher is doing at any given time. I'm sure there's somebody who could do that, but just hasn't or doesn't care to. But this patcher also was well known for causing the BioShock series to not play on the Steam Deck, because why would you ever want to play a 2K game that's older than Civ 6?
Last year.
I mean, if you want to use the launcher to launch your modern titles, fine. I don't need your stupid launcher to launch BioShock. I mean, those games came out 10-ish years ago, at least. Some of them are older than that, but...
It seems silly that you'd still be concerned about the piracy for something that old. It's like, at this point, you've already... Are you that concerned about the extra $30 a month you might get from people picking up an old game? I'm still doing this.
I'm going to be honest. I'm sure that it has nothing to do with piracy, because if you are going to do the piracy thing on these programs, these games, the only way to ensure that you're not going to pirate is to do something like an always online type thing. And even those can be spoofed by the hackers. Like the pirate people, they have it cracked within a few days of launch, no matter what. So I don't think it has anything to do with the piracy thing. I think it has everything to do with advertising. They want to get people in their ecosystem and advertise to them without Steam saying what's allowed and what's not. Because as much as we have problems with Steam sometimes, they do have pretty strict rules about not blatantly lying to customers and such.
Yeah.
And it's... Basically, Steam has some restrictions to it that publishers are not able to so easily trick their customers with it. And then the rest of the article, how to disable the 2K launcher for Marvel's Midnight Suns on Steam. So, actually, what I'm going to do is I'm going to pull up 2K launcher right now on my laptop, and I will describe all of the features it has very clearly. So we'll see what it actually looks like. For the first time, I'm actually going to start it up on the live stream.
Oh, man. This means you're going to start playing Rocket League again, isn't it?
Is Rocket League a 2K game?
Well, if you're willing to open one launcher, you might as well be willing to open any.
Ew.
Epic Games is not a launcher. It is a virus.
It's the same thing.
No?
They're not that different.
We're not having this conversation again. Because you're trolling me. Okay. The 2K launcher, the 2K launcher has now started. According to the 2K launcher, my Civilization 4 game has four DLCs owned. I own Gathering Storm, Rise and Fall, New Frontier Pass and the Vikings DLC. What? Okay, so not only does their launcher not work nice for players, it doesn't even tell you all the DLC. Also, it looks like it has a store built into it.
Don't have the thing? Buy it right now!
It has, like, four links for various high-profile social media networks. YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Why are Facebook and Instagram both there? You only need one. They're the same company, damn it. There's a related tabs. There's a system requirements and a more, which goes to game details, which is just the thing you see when you click on the game in Steam. And supported languages, which is almost an exact copy of the thing you get on the side of the Steam store page. So as I'm looking at this, there is literally nothing here that is any different than the Steam store page. And yeah, just completely useless. Nothing needed. There's no reason this needs to exist. And scene. Unless anybody else has something to say about it now.
Not really, no.
Okay.
Well, that has been episode 416 of Polycast. I'm Makalur, joined today as usual by Canis Albinus.
We will eventually get through this. We will destroy the launchers one at a time until they no longer exist.
And the Mian team.
No, we will not, because the best launcher is a rocket launcher.
Have we talked about how the Paradox launcher has to be fully deleted and then reloaded to even work sometimes?
No, we haven't, I don't think.
Have we talked about...
Probably not the time.
Oh, isn't it?
Well, this is bye-bye time, not new topic time.
Oh,
get
well.
Out.
All right.
Besides, you can't get rid of all launchers because rocket launchers are a thing. I'm just saying.
Yeah... Civilization 3, 4, 5, Beyond Earth, and 6 Sound Clips, copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright the Polycast at thepolycast.net.